Disc 6.
55. At the corner of 83rd and Lexington, a delivery truck struck a pedestrian, an elderly woman. Benton Wesley overhears excited talk in the gawking crowd as emergency lights flash, the block cordoned off in yellow crime scene tape. The fatal accident occurred less than an hour earlier at lunchtime, and Benton has seen enough gore in his life to walk swiftly past and respectfully avert his eyes from the body trapped under one of the truck's back tires. He catches the words brains and decapitated and something about dentures lying on the street. If the public had its way, every death scene would be pay-per-view. $5 for a ticket, and you can stare at blood and guts to your heart's content. When he used to arrive at crime scenes and all the cops would move out of the way to allow his expert eye to take in every detail, he had the right to order unauthorized people to leave. He could vent his disgust as he pleased, sometimes calmly, sometimes not. He surveys the area from behind his dark glasses, his lean body moving along the crowded sidewalk, cutting in and out with the agility of a lynx. A plain black baseball cap covers his shaved head, and he backtracks toward Lucy's headquarters, having gotten out of a taxi 10 blocks north instead of directly in front of her building or even near it. Benton probably could walk right past Lucy and say, "Excuse me," and she would not recognize him. 6 years it has been since he has seen or talked to her, and he is desperate to know what she looks like, sounds like, acts like. Anxiety presses him onward at his determined pace until he nears the modern polished granite building on 75th Street. A doorman stands in front, hands behind his back. He is hot in his gray uniform and shifts his weight from leg to leg, indicating that his feet hurt.
"I'm looking for the last precinct," Benton says to him.
"The what?"
The doorman looks at him as if he's crazy.
Benton repeats himself.
"You talking about some kind of police precinct?"
The doorman scrutinizes him, and homeless and wacko register on his jaded Irish face.
"Well, maybe you mean the precinct on 69th.
21st floor, suite 2103, Benton replies.
"Yeah, now I know what you're talking about, but it ain't called the last precinct. 2103's a software company, you know, computer stuff."
"You sure?"
"Hell, I work here, don't I?"
The doorman is getting impatient, and he glares at a woman whose dog is sniffing too close to the planter in front of the building.
"Hey," he says to her, "no dogs doing their business in the hedge."
"She's just sniffing,"
the woman indignantly replies, jerking the leash, tugging her hapless toy poodle back to the middle of the sidewalk. Having asserted himself, the doorman ignores the woman and her dog. Benton digs in a pocket of his faded jeans and pulls out a folded piece of paper. He smooths it open and glances at an address and phone number that have nothing to do with Lucy or her building or the office that really is called the last precinct, despite what the doorman thinks. If the doorman happens to relay to her, perhaps in jest, that some weirdo stopped by asking for the last precinct, she will go on the alert, get very worried. Marino believes that Jean-Baptiste knows Lucy's company by that name. Benton wants Marino and Lucy on the alert and worried.
"Says here, 2103, Benton tells the doorman, shoving the piece of paper back in his pocket. "What's the name of the company? Maybe the information I was given is wrong."
The doorman steps inside and picks up a clipboard. Running his finger down a page, he replies,
"Okay, okay. 2103. Like I said, some computer outfit. Info Search Solutions. You want to go up? I got to call them and see an ID."
An ID, yes, but calling isn't necessary, and Benton is amused. The doorman is openly rude and prejudiced toward the scruffy stranger before him, no longer mindful, as many New Yorkers aren't, that the city's greatest virtue in the past was to welcome scruffy strangers, desperately poor immigrants who barely spoke English. Benton speaks English exquisitely when he chooses, and he isn't poor, although his funds are regulated. He reaches inside his jacket for his wallet and produces a driver's license. Stephen Leonard Glover, age 44, born in Ithaca, New York, no longer Tom Haviland, because Marino knows him by that alias. Whenever Benton has to change his identity, which he does whenever needed, he suffers a period of depression and meaninglessness.
finding himself once again angrier than is necessary and all the more determined to prevail without burning with hate. Hate destroys the vessel that holds it. To hate is to lose clarity of mind and vision. Throughout his life he has resisted hate, and it would be all too easy and appropriate to hate the hate-filled, sadistic, and unremorseful offenders he has relentlessly tracked and trapped beyond what was appropriate while he was with the FBI. Benton's gift at evasion and imperviousness would not be possible if he hated or gave in to any extreme of emotion. He became Scarpetta's lover while he was still married, and perhaps that is his only sin he won't forgive. He can't bear to imagine the anguish Connie and their daughters suffered when they believed he was murdered. At times he considers his exile punishment for what he did to his family, because he was weak and gave in to an extreme of an emotion that he still feels. Scarpetta has that effect on him, and he would commit the same sin again. He knows it. Were he to go back in time when they first realized what they were feeling for each other. His only excuse, a weak one he knows, is that their lust and falling in love wasn't premeditated by either one of them. It happened. It simply happened. "I'll call him up for you," the doorman says, returning the fraudulent ID to Benton. "Thank you. What is your name?" "Jim." "Thank you, Jim, but that won't be necessary." Benton walks off, ignoring a don't walk sign, crossing 75th Street and becoming part of the anonymous flow of pedestrians along Lexington Avenue. Swerving under scaffolding, he pulls his cap lower, but behind his dark glasses his eyes miss nothing. Were any of the same oblivious people to pass him again on another block, he would recognize their faces, always aware and on guard. 3 times and he will tail whoever it is and capture him or her on his pocket-size video camera. He has amassed hundreds of tapes in the past 6 years, and so far they mean nothing beyond demonstrating that he lives in a very small world, no matter how big the city. Cops have an obvious presence in New York, sitting in their cruisers, talking to one another on sidewalks and street corners. Benton passes them, stoically looking straight ahead, his pistol strapped around his ankle. A violation so serious he would probably be tackled or slammed against a building were a cop to spot the gun. He would be handcuffed, stuffed inside a police car, interrogated, run through the FBI computer system, fingerprinted and arraigned in court, all to no avail, really. When he worked crime scenes, his prints were stored in APHIS, the automated fingerprint identification system. After his alleged death, his prints, including his 10-print card in cold storage, were altered, swapped with a man who had died of natural causes, and was surreptitiously fingerprinted in the embalming room of a Philadelphia funeral home. Benton's DNA profile is in no automated system anywhere on Earth. He steps into a doorway and dials directory assistance on a cell phone that has the billing address of a phone number at the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Programming the billing address was not so difficult. Benton has had years to become adept on the computer, using and violating cyberspace to his advantage. An occasional collect call added to the Texas Penitentiary's telephone bills is likely to escape notice, and could not be traced to anyone, certainly never to him. Benton knows that when he makes his call to Lucy's office, the Texas Penitentiary's name and number will show up on whatever sophisticated security system she has. Of course, all calls are taped. Of course, Lucy will have her own forensic voice analysis computer system. Of course, Benton has Jean-Baptiste's voice on tape and has had it for years, reaching back to the very dangerous days of an undercover operation that did not bring down the Shandun cartel, but instead annihilated Benton's identity and life. For this, Benton has not yet forgiven himself. He doesn't believe he will ever be able to give up his guilt and humiliation. He underestimated those whose trust was synonymous with his life. As a child, Benton and his magic ring made mistakes in his fantasy investigations. As an adult, he and his gold FBI ring have also made mistakes, errors in judgment, and flat-out wrong psychological assessments of murderers. But the one time in his career when he needed his acumen and wits the most, he slipped. And the thought of it still enrages him, sickens him, fills him with self-recrimination. He tells himself during his most despondent moments, no one else is to blame. Not even the Shandons and their minions are to blame. You dug your pit, and now you must get out of it. 56.
Just plain Jane copying paper,
Polunsky's public information officer Wayne Reeve explains to Scarpetta over the phone.
We buy it by the ream and sell it to the inmates for a penny a sheet. Envelopes are cheap white dime store variety, 3 for a quarter, he adds. If you don't mind my asking, why are you interested?
Research.
Oh?
His curiosity lingers. Forensic paper analysis. I'm a scientist. What if the inmate doesn't have commissary privileges? Scarpetta inquires from her office in Delray Beach. She was rushing out of the house with her suitcase when the phone rang. Rose answered it. Scarpetta eagerly took the call. She will miss her flight to New York.
He or she can get writing paper, envelopes, stamps, and so on. No one is denied that privilege, no matter what. You can understand it. Lawyers, Reeves says.
Scarpetta doesn't ask him if Jean-Baptiste Chandon is still on death row. She doesn't hint that she's gotten a letter from him and is no longer certain Chandon is safely locked up.
Enough, you son of a bitch. I've had enough, you son of a bitch. You want to see me, you'll see me, you son of a bitch. You want to talk, we'll talk all right, you son of a bitch. If you've escaped, I'm going to find out, you son of a bitch. If you did or didn't write this letter, I'm going to find out, you son of a bitch. You're not going to hurt anybody else, you son of a bitch. I want you dead, you son of a bitch.
Can you send me samples of commissary paper? She asks Reeve.
You'll get them tomorrow, he promises.
57. Turkey buzzards swoop low in the blue sky, the smell of death and decay drawing them to the marsh beyond the gray, weathered pier.
What'd you do, throw meat in the sawgrass?
Bev complains to Jay as she loops a rope over a piling.
You know how much I hate those damn buzzards.
Jay smiles, his attention on the lamb cowering in the stern of the boat. She rubs her wrists and ankles, her clothing partially unbuttoned and in disarray. For an instant, relief passes through her terrified eyes, as if the handsome blonde man on the dock couldn't possibly be evil. Jay wears nothing but threadbare cut-off jeans, the muscles in his sculpted tan body popping out with every move he makes. He lightly steps down into the boat.
Get inside, he orders Bev.
Hi, he says to the woman.
I'm Jay. You can relax now.
Her wide, glassy eyes are riveted to him. She keeps rubbing her wrists and wetting her lips.
Where am I?
She asks.
I don't understand.
Jay reaches out to help her up, and her legs won't work, so he grabs her around the waist.
There we go. A little stiff, are we?
He touches the dried, bloody clumps of hair matted to the back of her head, and his eyes burn.
She wasn't supposed to hurt you. You're hurt, aren't you? Okay, hold on. I'm going to pick you up, just like this.
He lifts her as if she weighs nothing.
Put your arms around my neck. Good.
He places her on the dock and climbs out after her. Helping her to her feet again, he picks her up and carries her inside the shack. Bev sits on the narrow, sour-smelling bed. It has no covers, just a dingy, rumpled, white, form-fitted sheet, and a stained pillow that has lost its shape and is almost flat. Bev's eyes follow Jay as he lowers the woman to the floor, holding her around the waist while she struggles for balance.
I can't seem to stand up, she says,
avoiding Bev, pretending Bev isn't there.
My feet are numb.
She tied you too tight, didn't she?
Jay says, as his eyes burn brighter.
What'd you do to her?
He asks Bev. Bev stares at him.
Get off the bed, he says to her. We need to let her lie down. She's hurt. Get a wet towel.
To the lamb, he says, as he helps her on the bed.
I don't have any ice, I'm sorry. Ice would be good for your head.
There's ice in the fish box.
And groceries, Bev says in a flat tone. You didn't bring me any pups, Jay comments.
I was busy and nothing was open.
Plenty of strays out there if you aren't too lazy to look for them.
She opens the refrigerator and pours cold water on a dish towel.
That's all right.
The lamb meekly replies, relaxing a little.
Jay is handsome and sweet. He is a friend, not horrid like that ugly beast of a woman. I'll be fine. I don't need any ice. It's not all right. Jay gently arranges the pillow under her head, and she cries out in pain. No, it's not all right. He slips a hand under her neck, moving her head so he can feel the back of it. The pressure of his fingers is too much, and the woman cries out again. What'd you do to her? He asks Bev. She fell in the boat. The woman says nothing and refuses to look at Bev. Fell with a little help, maybe? Jay asks, in a tone of perfect self-control. He gathers the lamb's blouse together and buttons it without touching her. 58. Benton takes off his jacket and drops it in a trash can. A block south, he tosses his baseball cap into another trash can and ducks into the shadows of scaffolding to unfasten his canvas knapsack. Inside is a black do-rag, and he ties it tightly around his head. He slips on a denim vest that has an American flag embroidered on the back. During a brief lull in pedestrian traffic, he substitutes his sunglasses for amber-tinted ones in different frames. Rolling up the knapsack, he tucks it under his arm and cuts left on 73rd Street, then left again on 3rd and back on 75th, where he stands at the corner of Lucy's building. Jim, the doorman, ignores him and wanders inside the lobby for a welcome rush of air conditioning. New technology is Benton's ally and enemy. Cell phone calls can be traced by more than caller ID. Signals bounce off satellites and boomerang to where the caller is located geographically when the call is made, and to date it is impossible to foil this technology. Benton has no choice but somehow to work around it. While caller ID will erroneously indicate that the call is being made from a Texas prison, the satellite transmission will reveal that the call was made in Manhattan, pinpointed to an area that is smaller than a city block. He uses this to his advantage, however. All obstacles can be steps to a higher benefit. Benton makes the call from Lucy's address at Lexington and 75th Street. Jean-Baptiste is on death row, and that is easy enough to check. Logic would dictate that Jean-Baptiste could not have called collect from Manhattan. Then who did? Lucy will puzzle over the call made in the immediate area of her office building, and knowing her as well as Benton does, he is certain she will make a call from her own address and see that the same coordinates are pinpointed by the satellite. This will lead her to the conclusion that there must have been a technical glitch, that somehow the transmission traced back to where the call was received instead of where it was initiated. She will not understand how this could have happened when it has never happened before. Lucy will be paranoid. Without a doubt, she will be angry, because she does not forgive sloppy work or technical screw-ups. She will blame the snafu on the telephone company or her staff. Probably the latter. As for Jim the doorman, when asked, he will say that at the precise moment the call was made, he saw no one on a cell phone in front of the building or close to it. This will be a lie. Almost everybody in New York walks around with a cell phone to his or her ear. The truth is, even if Jim remembers the precise time he left his post for the air-conditioned lobby, he won't want to admit it. The last obstacle is voice analysis, which Lucy will conduct immediately to verify that the caller was Jean-Baptiste Sean Dunn. That is no threat. Benton has spent several years meticulously studying, transcribing, and editing recordings of Jean-Baptiste's voice, then re-recording them into digital files with a single-directional microphone that, when used in a high-sensitivity mode, picks up multi-directional sound or background noise, in this case the inside of a prison. He edited and spliced it on a computer, and the results are seamless. Each file a blitz of sound bites intended for voicemail or a live recipient who has no chance for a response that would force a mental engagement that is impossible. Switching from menu to a folder he named Red Stick for Baton Rouge, he verifies the timestamp on the LCD and double-checks that all details of the setup are in order. He plugs the microphone into a speaker port and tucks in the earpiece. The phone at InfoSearch Solutions, the last precinct, is picked up. Manhattan. Collect call to InfoSearch Solutions on 75th, he says into the microphone.
Your name?
Polunsky Unit.
Please hold.
The operator connects the call.
Collect call from Polunsky Unit. Will you accept charges?
Yes, without pause or change of inflection. Good afternoon. May I ask who's calling? a male voice continues, the caller ID showing the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Benton sets noise cancel on high to eradicate the live feedback of New York traffic and other sounds that would be ruinous for a call supposedly made from the interior of a penitentiary. He presses play. The indicator light glows green, and file one begins.
When Mademoiselle Farinelli returns, tell her Baton Rouge.
Jean-Baptiste's recorded voice is as natural as if he himself is speaking in real time. She's out of the office. Who's calling? Who is this? The man in Lucy's office tries to talk to what is nothing more than a memory chip on the line. May I give her a message? The call ended 7 seconds ago. Benton erases file one from Red Stick to ensure that Jean-Baptiste's faked message cannot be played again, ever, by anyone. He walks swiftly along the congested sidewalk again, head bent, missing nothing. 59.
Please don't hurt me, the lamb says.
Jay helps the woman sit up. She cries and moans as he gently cleans her bloody hair, worrying about the split in her scalp caused by the blunt force trauma of her head cracking against the outboard motor. He reassures her that the injury isn't serious and didn't fracture her skull. She's not seeing double, is she?
No,
she says, her breath catching as he touches her hair again with the wet, bloody towel.
I can see fine.
Jay's sweetness, his protectiveness, has the usual effect, and the woman's attention is fixed only on him. She identifies with him to the extent that she feels she can tell him that Bev, whose name the woman doesn't know, pushed her into the outboard motor.
That's how I hit my head, she confides to Jay.
He tosses the bloody towel to Bev. She hasn't moved, just stands in the middle of the small room, staring at him like a cotton mouth coiled to strike. The towel lands at her feet, and she doesn't pick it up. He tells her to pick it up. Bev doesn't. Pick it up and wash it in the sink, he says. I don't want to look at that thing on the floor. You shouldn't have hurt her. Clean the towel and get all this insect repellent off her.
I don't need her to get it off me, the woman pleads. Maybe it's good to keep it on because of all the bugs.
No, you need it washed off, Jay says, leaning close and smelling her neck. You have too much on. It's toxic. She must have soaked you with an entire bottle. That's not good.
I don't want her touching me again.
She hurt you?
The lamb doesn't answer.
I'm here. She won't hurt you.
Jay gets up from the edge of the bed, and Bev collects the wet, gory towel.
We don't need to waste water, she says. The tank's low.
It's supposed to rain eventually, Jay replies, studying the woman as if she's a car he might buy. The tank's got plenty anyway.
Wash the towel and bring it back in here.
Please don't hurt me.
The woman lifts her head up from the pillow. It is pinkish and wet, and a bright red spot indicates that her laceration has begun to bleed again.
Just take me home, and I won't tell anybody. Not anybody, I swear to God.
Her eyes plead with Jay, her only hope, because he's glorious to look at, and so far he's been nice.
Won't tell anybody what?
Jay asks her, moving closer, sitting on the edge of the iron frame bed with its foul, broken-down mattress.
What's there to tell? You hurt yourself, now didn't you? And we're good Samaritans taking care of you.
She nods, uncertainty, then fear contorting her face.
Make it quick, please,
she whispers between convulsions, sobs and hiccups jerking her body.
If you aren't going to let me go, make it quick.
Bev returns with the towel and hands it to Jay. Water drips on the bed and trickles down his bare, muscular arm. Bev runs her fingers through his hair and kisses the back of his neck, then presses close to him as he opens the woman's blouse.
Ah, no bra, he says. She wasn't wearing one.
He cranes his head around, demanding an answer in a soft voice that by now has become scary. Bev slides her hands down his sweaty chest. The woman's eyes are wide with the same glassy terror that Bev saw in the boat. She trembles violently, her naked breasts quivering. A drop of saliva slips out of the side of her mouth, and Jay stands up, disgusted. Get the rest of her clothes off and clean her up, he orders Bev. You touch her again, you know what I'll do to you. Bev smiles. Theirs is a well-rehearsed, long-running drama. 60. The next morning, Scarpetta is still in Florida. Once again, she was about to leave and was waylaid, this time by FedEx delivering two packages, one from the Polunsky public information officer, the other a thick package containing Charlotte Dard's case, mostly copies of autopsy and lab reports and histological slides. Scarpetta places a slide of the left ventricular free wall on the compound microscope's stage. If she could add up the hours she spent looking at slides throughout her career, the number would be in the tens of thousands. Although she respects the histologist, whose devotion is to the minuscule structures of tissues and the tales their cells can tell, she has never been able to comprehend sitting inside a tiny lab day in and day out, surrounded by sections of heart, lung, liver, brain, and other organs, and injuries and stigmata of diseases that are cut into sections and turn rubbery inside bottles of a fixative such as formalin. Each tissue section is embedded in paraffin wax or a plastic resin and shaved into slices thin enough for light to pass through them. After they are mounted on glass slides, they are stained with a variety of dyes that were developed by the 19th century textile industry. Mostly, Scarpetta sees a lot of pinks and blues, but there is a profusion of colors used depending on the tissue and the cellular structure and possible defects that need to give up their secrets to her at the other end of the lens. Dyes, like diseases, are often named for whoever discovered or invented them, and this is where histology becomes unnecessarily complicated, if not annoying. It isn't enough for dyes or dyeing techniques to be called blue or violet. They must be Cressel blue, Cressel violet, or Pearl's Prussian blue, or Heidenhain's hematoxylin, purplish red, or Masson's trichrome, blue and green, or Bielshovsky, neutral red, or her favorite mundanity, Jones' methanamine silver. A typical egocentric pathological legacy is a Van Giessen staining of a Schwann cell nuclei from a schwannoma, and Scarpetta fails to understand why German physiologist Theodor Schwann would have wanted a tumor named after him. She peers into the lens at the contraction bands in the pink-stained tissue shaved from a section of Charlotte Dard's heart at autopsy. Some fibers are missing their nuclei, indicating necrosis or the death of tissue. And other slides reveal pink and blue stained inflammation and old scarring, and narrowing of the coronary arteries. The Louisiana woman was only 32 when she dropped dead at the door of a motel room in Baton Rouge, dressed to go out, keys in hand. It was suspected 8 years ago at the time of her death that her family pharmacist illegally gave her the powerful pain medication OxyContin found in her pocketbook. She didn't have a prescription for the drug. In a letter to Scarpetta, Dr. Lanier suggests that this pharmacist might have fled to Palm Desert, California. Dr. Lanier doesn't indicate what he bases this possibility on or offer further details for his reopening Charlotte Dard's case. It is a mess for multiple reasons. The case is old. There is no evidence the drug came from the pharmacist, and even if it did, unless he premeditated killing her with OxyContin, he is not guilty of first-degree murder. At the time of Charlotte Dard's death, he would not talk to the police, but through his attorney claimed that a family friend with a ruptured disc must have given Charlotte Dard OxyContin, and she accidentally overdosed on it. Several copies of letters sent 8 years ago to Dr. Lanier are from the pharmacist's attorney, Rocco Caggiano. 61. Beyond the window in front of Scarpetta's desk, shadows crawl over sand dunes as the sun moves. Palm fronds rattle lightly, and a man walking his yellow lab on the beach leans into a headwind. Far off on the hazy blue horizon, a container ship forges south, probably to Miami. If Scarpetta is too caught up in her work, she will forget the time and where she is, and soon will miss another flight to New York. Dr. Lanier answers his phone and is hoarse as he says, "Hello?" "You sound terrible," Scarpetta says sympathetically.
"I don't know what I caught, but I feel like hell. Thanks for getting back to me.
What meds are you taking? I hope it's decongestants and a cough suppressant with an expectorant and that you're staying away from antihistamines. Try the daytime or non-drowsy formulas that don't list antihistamines or doxylamine succinate on the label, unless you want to dry yourself out and get a bacterial infection. And stay away from alcohol. It lowers your immunities. He blows his nose.
I'm a real medical doctor, just so you know. And an addictionologist, meaning I do know a thing or two about drugs.
He says this without a trace of defensiveness.
Thought you might be relieved to hear that.
Scarpetta is embarrassed for making assumptions. Coroners are elected officials, and unfortunately, nationwide, many of them are not physicians. I didn't mean to insult you, Dr. Lanier.
You didn't. By the way, your sidekick, Pete Marino, thinks you walk on water.
You checked me out. She is nonplussed. Good. Now, hopefully, we can get down to business. I've been through Charlotte Dard's case.
An oldie but goodie, and I don't mean that literally. There's nothing good about it. Hold on. Let me get something to write with. Unquestionably, there's a Bermuda Triangle for pens, and in my home, it's my beloved wife. All right.
Mrs. Dard's case is definitely perplexing, Scarpetta begins. As you know from her tox reports, oxymorphone, the metabolite of OxyContin, is only 4 milligrams per liter of blood, which puts her in the low-lethal range. Her gastric is negative, and the level in her liver's no higher than the level in her blood. In other words, death from an overdose of OxyContin is equivocal. Clearly, her drug level isn't as critical as her clinical findings.
I agree. My thought all along. If you interpret her tox in light of the histological findings, it's possible she didn't need as high a level for an accidental overdose. Although her reports and body diagrams don't indicate any cutaneous stigmata of past intravenous drug abuse, he adds. So I'm guessing she was a pill popper but didn't shoot up.
Certainly she was a chronic drug abuser, Scarpetta says. Her heart tells us that. Patchy necrosis and fibrosis of varying age and chronic ischemia, plus an absence of coronary artery disease or cardiomegaly. Basically a coke heart. It is a catch-all phrase that does not necessarily mean the person was a cocaine addict. Drugs such as narcotics, synthetic narcotics, OxyContin, hydrocodone, Percocet, Percodan, and whatever else the addict can get his or her hands on will destroy the heart just as completely as cocaine will. Elvis Presley is a sad example.
I need to ask you about blackouts, Dr. Lanier says after a pause.
What about them? This must be what he so urgently wanted to talk to her about. I saw nothing in the case file you sent me that mentions blackouts. She checks her irritation. As a private consultant, she is limited by the medico-legal information presented to her, and the absence of pertinent findings, or the presence of incorrect findings, is intolerable. Until she gave up working her own cases or supervising those worked by her other forensic pathologists throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia, she did not have to rely on the competence or veracity of virtual strangers.
Charlotte Dard suffered occasional blackouts, Dr. Lanier explains. Or at least this is what I was told at the time.
Who told you?
Her sister. It appears, he goes on, or let me qualify this by saying it is alleged that she suffered from retrograde amnesia.
I certainly would think her family would know that, unless no one was ever home.
Problem is, her husband, Jason Dard's, a rather shady character. Nobody around here knows much, maybe nothing about him, except he's rich as hell and lives on an old plantation. I wouldn't call Mrs. Guidon a reliable witness. Although she certainly could be telling the truth about her sister's condition prior to her death.
I've read the police narrative, which is brief. Tell me what you know. After a coughing bout, Dr. Lanier replies,
The hotel where she died is in a not-so-nice part of the city, in my jurisdiction. A housekeeper found her body.
What about blood tests? In the paperwork you sent me, all I got were post-mortem levels, so I don't know whether she might have had the elevated GGTP or CDT associated with alcohol abuse.
Since I first contacted you, I have managed to track down pre-mortem blood test results, because she was in the hospital about 2 weeks before her death. Misfiled, I'm embarrassed to say. I've got a particular clerk I'd pay heaven and earth to get rid of, but she's the sort to sue for one thing or another.
The answer to your question is no. No elevated GGTP or CDT.
In the hospital for what?
Tests after her most recent blackout. So, obviously, she had one of these blackouts 2 weeks before she died. Again, I say allegedly.
Well, if she didn't have elevated GGTP or CDT, it would seem to me that we can rule out alcohol as the cause of her blackouts, Scarpetta replies. And Dr. Lanier, I can't offer you a second opinion if I'm not supplied with all of the information.
Be nice if I was supplied all the information, too. Don't get me started on the police down here.
What was Mrs. Dard's behavior during her blackouts?
Supposedly violent. Throwing things, trash in the house or wherever she was staying. On one occasion, she vandalized her Maserati by smashing the windows, doors, and hood with a hammer. She poured bleach all over the leather seats.
A record of this with a body shop?
It happened in May of 1995 and required 2 months to repair the damage. Then her husband traded it in on a new one for her.
That wasn't her last blackout, though. Scarpetta flips to another page in her legal pad, writing quickly and illegibly.
No, the last one, 2 weeks before her death, was in the fall, September 1st, 1995. On that occasion, she took a razor of some sort to paintings valued at more than $1 million, supposedly.
This was in her home?
In a parlor, as I understand it.
Witnessed?
Only the aftermath, based on what I'm told. Again, this is according to what her sister and husband said way back when.
Certainly her drug abuse could cause blackouts. Another possibility is temporal lobe epilepsy. Any record of her having suffered a head injury?
None that I'm aware of. And no old fractures or scarring showed up on X-ray and gross examination. Hospital records indicate that after her second blackout, which, as I've said, was September 1st, 1995, she went through the gamut of tests, MRI, PET scan, and so on. Nothing. Of course, temporal lobe epilepsy doesn't always show up, and maybe she did suffer some sort of head injury and we just don't know about it. Hard to imagine. I'm inclined to think her drug abuse was to blame.
Based on the information I have, I agree. Her findings correlate with chronic abuse and not from one single overdose of OxyContin. Sounds like the only answer as to manner of death is investigation.
Jesus God, that's the problem. The cops who worked the case didn't do shit, and sure as hell aren't going to do shit now. Hell, everything's a problem down here. Except the food.
Mrs. Dard is probably a heart attack with chronic drug abuse as a contributing factor, Scarpetta tells him. That's the most I can offer you.
Doesn't help that we've got an idiot of a U.S. attorney, Weldon Wynn, Dr. Lanier continues to complain. Since this damn serial killer's been on the loose, a lot of people are sticking their noses in everything. Politics.
I presume you're on the task force, Scarpetta interrupts him.
No, they say I'm not needed, since no bodies have turned up.
And if a body does turn up, you don't need to know anything about the investigation, even though it's believed that each of the women was murdered? Everything you're telling me goes from bad to worse, Scarpetta says.
You're absolutely right. I haven't been invited to look at the scenes of their abductions. I haven't looked at their homes, cars, not a single crime scene.
Well, you should have, Scarpetta replies. When a person is abducted and assumed to be a homicide, the police should ask you to look at everything and know every detail. You should be fully informed.
Should doesn't mean crap down here.
How many of the abducted women are, or were, from your parish?
So far, 7.
And you haven't been to a single scene of an abduction? I'm sorry to keep asking you the same questions, but I'm incredulous. And now those scenes no longer exist, am I right?
Cases are as cold as an ice block, he replies.
I guess the cars are still impounded, and at least that's a good thing. But you can't secure a parking lot or house forever, and I have no idea what's happened with their homes.
He pauses to cough.
It's going to happen again. Soon, he's escalating.
62. The sky is turning a dirty blue with haze, and the wind picks up. Scarpetta picks through paperwork as she talks to Dr. Lanier. Just now she finds a copy of the death certificate, folded up inside an envelope. The document isn't certified and should not have been released by Dr. Lanier's office. Only vital records would be authorized to send Scarpetta or any other requesting party a copy, a certified one.
When Scarpetta was chief, it would have been unthinkable for one of her clerks to make such an egregious error. She mentions the problematic copy of the death certificate, adding, "I'm not trying to interfere with how you run your office, but thought you should know."
"God damn," he exclaims.
"Let me guess which clerk. And don't assume it was a mistake. Some people around here would love nothing better than to get me into serious trouble."
The maiden name on her death certificate is Donardi, her father Bernard Donardi, her mother Sylvie Gaillot Donardi. Charlotte Donardi Dard was born in Paris.
"Dr. Scarpetta?"
She vaguely hears his hoarse voice and coughing. Her mind locks on the abducted women, on Charlotte Dard's suspicious death, and the information blackout that keeps the coroner clueless. The Louisiana legal system is infamous for corruption.
"Dr. Scarpetta, you there? Did I lose you?"
Jean-Baptiste Chandon is scheduled to die soon.
"Hello?"
"Dr. Lanier," she finally says, "let me ask you something. How did you hear about me?"
"Oh, good. I thought we'd gotten disconnected. An indirect referral. A rather unorthodox one, suggesting I contact Pete Marino. That led me to you."
"An unorthodox referral from whom?" He waits for another coughing fit to pass.
"A guy on death row."
"Let me guess. Jean-Baptiste Chandon."
"I'm not surprised you would figure that out. I've been checking, I admit it. You have a pretty scary history with him."
"Let's don't go into that," she says. "I also assume he's the source of information about Charlotte Dard. And by the way, Rocco Caggiano, the lawyer who represented our mysterious pharmacist who allegedly fled to Palm Desert, he's also Chandon's lawyer."
"Now that I didn't know. You think Chandon had something to do with Charlotte Dard's death?"
"I'm betting that he or someone either in his family or associated with it did," she says. 63. Lucy isn't showered, her usual demeanor in the office fractured by exhaustion and by post-traumatic stress that she will not acknowledge. Her clothes look slept in because they were, twice. Once in Berlin when the flight was cancelled, and the next time in Heathrow when she and Rudy had to wait 3 hours to board an 8-hour flight that landed them at Kennedy Airport not even an hour ago. At least they had no baggage to lose, their few belongings stuffed into one small carry-on duffel bag. Before leaving Germany, they showered and disposed of the clothing they had worn in room 511 of the Szczecin Radisson Hotel. Lucy wiped all prints off her tactical baton and, without a pause in her step, tossed it through the slightly open window of a dented Mercedes on the side of a quiet, narrow street crowded with parked cars. Certainly the Mercedes owner would puzzle over the baton and wonder who deposited it inside his or her front seat and why. "Merry Christmas," Lucy muttered, and she and Rudy briskly walked off into the dawn. The morning was too dark and cool for blowflies, but with the afternoon, when Rudy and Lucy were long gone, the flies would awaken in Poland. More of the filthy winged insects would find Rocco Caggiano's slightly open window and heavily drone inside to feed on his cold, stiff body. The flies should be busy depositing hundreds, maybe thousands, of eggs. Lucy's chief of staff, Zach Manham, needs but one piece of evidence to deduce that his boss is not herself and that something very bad happened wherever she's just been. She reeks of body odor. Even when Madam has spent hours in the gym or run miles with Lucy, she doesn't stink. Not like this. Hers is the strong odor of fear and stress. Its secretion requires little perspiration, which is clammy and concentrated in the armpits and strongly permeates clothing, becoming more unpleasant and noticeable with time. Accompanying this acute reaction is an elevated heartbeat, shallow breathing, pallor, and constricted pupils. Manham doesn't know the physiology of a response he learned to recognize early in his former career as a detective for the New York District Attorney's Office, but he doesn't need to know.
"Go home and get some rest," he repeatedly says to Lucy.
"Cut it out!" she finally barks at him, interested in the large digital recorder on Manham's desk. She slips on headphones and presses the play button again, manipulating the volume. For the third time, she listens to the cryptic message that their highly technical caller identification system has narrowed down to the Polunsky unit,
While the satellite tracking system indicates the call was made from virtually the front door of Lucy's office building, or perhaps even inside it. Hitting the off button, she sits down, worn out and beside herself.
God damn it! God damn it! She exclaims. I don't get it. You screw up something, Zack?
She rubs her face, a residue of mascara sticky on her eyelashes and driving her crazy. When she played the role of pretty young thing who seemed perfectly in place at the Radisson in Szczecin, she somehow grabbed a tube of waterproof mascara, and she hates mascara and she had no makeup remover because she's rather much a stranger to cosmetics. So she scrubbed her face hard, succeeding only in getting soap in her eyes, which are bloodshot and puffy, as if she had been drinking all night. With rare exception, alcohol on the job is forbidden, and the first words out of her mouth when she appeared in her office not even an hour ago, leaving a jet stream of stench whenever she moved, was that she had not been on a bender, as if Manum or anybody else would have suspected for even 2 seconds that she had been.
"I didn't screw up anything, Lucy,"
Manum patiently replies, looking at her with concern. He is moving closer to 50 years old, fit, 6 feet tall, with thick brown hair and a brush of gray at the temples, his former thick Bronx accent neutralized or altered when necessary. Manum is a natural mimic. Amazingly, he can fit into virtually any environment. Women find him irresistibly attractive and entertaining, and he uses this to his professional advantage. Moral judgments do not exist at the last precinct, unless an investigator is foolish and selfish enough to violate an unbending code of impeccable behavior. One's personal choices must never, absolutely never, come within miles of the boundaries of missions that place lives at risk daily.
I honestly have no idea what happened here, why the satellite tracking system pinpoints the immediate area of this building,
Manum tells her.
I contacted Polunsky and Jean-Baptiste is there. They say he's there. He could not have been here. That would be impossible unless he can levitate, for Christ's sake.
I think what you mean is travel out of body, Lucy retorts, and her unfairness and arrogance are uncontrollable right now, and she feels terrible about it. Levitate means to hover, off the ground. She feels powerless because her usually brilliant and logical mind cannot decipher what has happened, and she wasn't here when it happened. Manum politely looks at her.
It's him. You sure?
Lucy knows Jean-Baptiste's voice, soft, almost sweet, with a heavy French accent. His is a voice she will never forget. It's him, all right, she says. Go ahead and run voice analysis, but I already know what it's going to show. And I think Polunsky needs to prove that the asshole they've got on death row is really Sean Dunn, as in proving it with DNA. Maybe his fucking family's pulled something. If need be, I'll go there and look at his ugly face myself. She hates that she hates him. No competent investigator can give in to emotions, or judgment is obscured, even deadly. But Jean-Baptiste tried to kill Lucy's aunt. For that, she despises him. For that, he should die. Painfully, Lucy wishes. For what he intended and attempted, he should feel the abject terror he inflicted on others and lusted to inflict on Scarpetta.
Demand a new DNA test? Lucy, we need a court order.
Manum is aware of jurisdictional and legal limitations and has lived by their standards for so long that he is programmed to at least worry when Lucy suggests a plan that in the past would have been unthinkable and impossible, and if nothing else would have resulted in a suppression of evidence that would destroy a case in court.
Berger can request it.
Lucy refers to Assistant DA Jamie Berger.
Give her a call and ask her to come over here as soon as she can, like right now.
Manum has to smile.
I'm sure she has nothing to do, and will welcome the diversion.
64. Scarpetta spreads out dozens of 8x10 color photographs she made by placing each sheet of the Polunsky commissary paper on a light box, and photographing all of them under ultraviolet light, and then again at a magnification of 50 times. She compares them to photographs of the Sean Dunn letter she received. The paper has no watermarks and is composed of closely matted wood fibers, common in cheap paper as opposed to fine papers that include rag. Visually, the paper has a smooth, shiny surface, typical in typing paper, and she sees no irregularities that might suggest it came from the same manufacturer's batch,
which doesn't matter, really. Even if the paper did come from the same batch, that scientific evidence would be weak in court, because the defense would instantly insist that because of the enormous size of a manufacturer's batch, inexpensive grades of paper such as this, all produced with untold millions and millions of sheets to a batch. The 8.5 by 11, 20-pound paper is no different from what Scarpetta uses in her printer. Ironically, the defense might make a case that she wrote the Chandon letter and mailed it to herself. She has been subjected to more ridiculously bizarre accusations than that. She doesn't fool herself. Once accused, always accused, and she has been accused of too many professional, legal, and moral breaches to survive the intense scrutiny of anyone who might wish to destroy her again. Rose peeks her head into Scarpetta's office.
If you don't leave right this minute, you're going to miss another flight.
65. Buying coffee on the street is an old routine that gives Jamie Berger a temporary escape from mayhem. She takes her change from Raoul, thanks him, and he nods, busy, aware of the long line behind her, and asks if she wants butter, even though she has refused butter for all the years she has patronized his kiosk across Center Street from the district attorney's office. She walks off with her coffee and usual high-carbohydrate lunch of a bagel, this one poppy seed, and 2 packets of Philadelphia cream cheese in a white paper bag with a napkin and a plastic knife. The cell phone on her belt vibrates like a stinging insect. Yes, she answers, pausing on the sidewalk across from her granite building downtown, close to Ground Zero, where on September 11, 2001, she was looking out her office window when the second plane crashed into the World Trade Center. That empty hole along the Hudson has left an empty hole in her, too. Staring at blank air, at what is no longer there, makes her feel older than her 48 years, and with every passing era in her life, she has lost a part of herself that can never be resurrected.
"What are you doing?" Lucy asks. "I hear street chaos. So you're in the midst of cops, lawyers, and thugs swarming around the courthouse. How quickly can you get to the Upper East Side, where things are more civilized?"
Typically, Lucy doesn't give Berger an opportunity to get in a word until it is too late for her to say no.
"You're not scheduled for court, are you?"
Berger says that she's not.
"I suppose you want me now."
Realistically speaking, now is more like 45 minutes due to sluggish traffic. It is close to 1 p.m. when Berger is keyed up to the 21st floor of Lucy's building. The elevator doors open to a mahogany reception area with Info Search Solutions in brass letters on the wall behind the curved glass desk. There is no area for clients to wait, and the desk is flanked by 2 opaque glass doors. The left one electronically unlocks as the elevator doors shut, an invisible camera in the chandelier broadcasting Berger and every sound she makes on platinum-screen TVs in every interior office.
"You look like holy hell, but what matters is how I look," she dryly says as Lucy greets her.
"You're very photogenic," Lucy replies with a quip she's used before. "You could have had a brilliant acting career in Hollywood." Berger is a brilliant, dark-haired woman with sharp features and pretty teeth. She is always dressed impeccably in power suits, accented by expensive accessories, and although she might not think of herself as an actor, any good prosecutor is theatrical during interviews, and certainly in the courtroom. Berger looks around at a wall of closed mahogany doors. One opens, and Zach Manham walks out holding a stack of CDs.
"Step into my parlor," Lucy says to Berger. "A spider's turned up."
"A tarantula," Manham gravely adds.
"How you doing, boss?"
He shakes Berger's hand.
"Still miss the good old days?"
Berger smiles at him, but her eyes belie her light demeanor. Losing Manham from the DA's detective squad, or from her A-team, as she calls it, still hurts, even though it is for the best, and she continues to work with him at times such as this one. Another era passed.
"Step this way," Manham says.
Berger follows him and Lucy inside what is simply referred to as the lab. The room is large and soundproof, like a professional recording studio. Overhead shelves are stacked with sophisticated audio, video, and global positioning and various tracking systems that defy Berger's expertise and never cease to amaze her when she comes to Lucy's office. Everywhere lights blink and video screens flash from one image to another, some of them the interior of the building, others monitoring locations that make no sense to Berger. She notices what looks like a bundle of tiny microphones on top of a desk crowded with modems and monitors. "What's this latest contraption?" she asks. "Your latest jewelry. An ultra-micro-transmitter," Lucy replies, picking up the bundle and pulling loose one of the transmitters, no bigger than a quarter and attached to a long, thin cord. "It goes with this." She taps what looks like a black box with jacks and an LCD. "We can disappear this baby in the hem of one of your Armani jackets, and if you get snatched, the quasi-Doppler direction finder can locate your exact position by VHF and UHF signals. Frequency range 27 to 500 megahertz. Channel selected on a simple keyboard, and this other thing you're looking at," she pats the black box, "is a tracking system we can use to monitor wherever the hell you are in your car, on your motorcycle, your bicycle. Nothing more than a crystal oscillator powered by a NiCad battery. Can monitor up to 10 targets at a time, supposing your husband's screwing around on you with multiple women." Berger doesn't react to a subtlety that is anything but subtle. "Water-resistant," Lucy goes on. "A nice carrying case with a shoulder strap. Could probably get Gurkha or Hermes to design a special one, perhaps an ostrich or kangaroo, just for you. Aircraft antenna available if you want to feel secure when you fly on a Learjet, a Gulfstream, however you get about, woman on the go that you are." "Another time," Berger says. "I hope you didn't bring me uptown to show me what happens if I get lost or kidnapped." "Actually, I didn't." Lucy sits before a large monitor. Her fingers rapidly tap on the keyboard as she flies through windows, moving deeper into a forensic scientific software application that Berger doesn't recognize. "You get this from NASA?" she asks. "Maybe," Lucy replies, pointing the cursor at a folder labeled with a number that, again, is meaningless to Berger. "NASA does a lot more than bring home moon rocks. Put it this way." Lucy pauses, hovering over a key, staring intensely at the screen. "I've got rocket scientist buddies at their R&D headquarters at Langley," she rolls the mouse around. "Lots of nice people there who don't get the credit they deserve. Tap, tap, tap. We've got some pretty amazing projects going on. Okay." She clicks on a file labeled with an accession number and today's date. "Here we go." She looks up at Berger. "Listen."
"Good afternoon. May I ask who's calling?"
The male voice on the tape is Zach Manham's.
"When Mademoiselle Farinelli returns, tell her Baton Rouge."
66. Berger pulls up a chair and sits down, riveted to the computer screen. Frozen on it are two voice prints or spectrograms, 2.5-second digital cuts of a taped human voice converted into electrical frequencies. The resulting patterns are black and white vertical and horizontal bands that, like Rorschach ink blots, evoke different imaginative associations, depending on who is looking at them. In this case, the voice prints remind Lucy of a black and white abstract painting of tornadoes. She mentions this to Berger and adds, "That figures, doesn't it? What I've done here, or should I say what the computer's done here, is find Sean Dunn's speech sounds from another source. In this case, your videotaped interview of him after his arrest in Richmond. The computer looked for matching words. Of course, the bastard didn't make that easy when you look at the words used in the call we got. Nowhere in his interview with you," Lucy goes on, "does he say Baton Rouge, for example, nor does he ever mention me, Lucy Farinelli, by name. That leaves when, returns, and tell her. Nowhere near as many sounds as I'd like for comparison. We'd like at least 20 matching speech sounds for a positive match. However, what we've got is a significant similarity. The darkest area on the known and questioned voice prints correspond to the intensity of the frequencies." She points out black areas of the voice prints on the computer screen.
"Looks the same to me," Berger remarks.
"Definitely. In the four words when, returns, and tell her, yes, I agree."
"Hey, I'm convinced," Manham says. "But in court we'd have a hard time for the reason Lucy said. We don't have enough matching sounds to convince a jury."
"Forget court for the moment," says New York's most respected prosecutor. Lucy strikes other keys and activates a second file.
"I begin to touch her breasts and Anouk her bra," says Jean-Baptiste's voice, that soft, polite voice.
Then Lucy says, "Here we go. Three other fragments of an interview that contains words for comparison."
"I was a bit confused at first when I tried to touch her and couldn't pull out her top."
Next is,
"But I can tell you are pretty," Jean-Baptiste Chandon says.
"More," says Lucy.
"It was a return ticket, coach to New York."
Lucy explains. "Our four words, Jamie. Close enough. As I indicated, these phrases are from your videotaped interview with him prior to his arraignment, when you were brought in as a special prosecutor." It is difficult for Lucy to hear segments of this interview. Vaguely, she resents Berger for forcing Scarpetta to watch the videotape, although it was necessary, completely necessary, to subject her to hours of what was nothing more than manipulative, violent pornography, after he had almost murdered her. Jean-Baptiste lied and enjoyed it. No doubt he was sexually aroused by the thought that Scarpetta, a victim and key witness, was his audience. For hours she watched and listened to him fabricate in detail not only what he did in Richmond, but his 1997 so-called romantic encounter with Susan Pless, a television meteorologist for CNBC, whose savage dead body was found inside her apartment in New York's Upper East Side. She was 28 years old, a beautiful African-American beaten and bitten in the same grotesque fashion as Chandon's other victims. Only in her murder, seminal fluid was recovered. In Jean-Baptiste's more recent slayings, the ones in Richmond, the victims were nude only from the waist up, and no seminal fluid was recovered, only saliva. That fact led to conclusions, based in part on DNA analysis, that the Chandon web is a tight weave of organized crime for profit and violent aberrance committed for sadistic sport. Jean-Baptiste and Jay Talley enjoy their non-profit sport. In the sexual slaying of Susan Pless, the two brothers tag-teamed, the debonair Jay seducing and raping Susan, then handing her off to his hideous, impotent twin. Lucy Berger and Manham look at the sound spectrograms on the computer screen. Although voice analysis is not an exact science, the three of them are convinced that the man who left the message and Jean-Baptiste Chandon are one and the same.
"As if I needed this."
Berger swipes her finger across the video screen, leaving a faint trail.
"I'd know the fucker's voice anywhere. Tornado. You got it. That's the damn truth. The way he tears through lives, and damn if it doesn't look like he's doing it again."
Lucy explained the satellite tracking that pointed to the immediate area around her building, while caller ID showed that the call was made from across the country, at the Polunsky unit in Texas. "How do we make sense of this?" Berger shakes her head.
"Unless there's some sort of technical glitch or some other explanation that eludes me, at least, at the moment."
"Most important, I want to know for a fact that Jean-Baptiste Chandon is still on death row in Texas and is scheduled to get the needle on May 7th, Lucy says.
"No kidding,"
Manham mutters, repeatedly clicking a pen, a nervous habit that annoys all who know him.
"Zack?"
Berger cocks an eyebrow, staring at the pen.
"Sorry."
He slides it into the breast pocket of his starched white shirt.
"Unless you two need me, I've got some calls to make."
He looks at both of them.
"We're fine. We'll fill you in later," Lucy says.
"And if anybody calls looking for me, the word is that nobody knows where I am."
"Not ready to come up for air?" Manham smiles.
"No."
He leaves, the muffled sound of the heavily padded door barely audible.
"And Rudy?" Berger asks. "Hopefully in his apartment, taking a shower or a nap. Looks like you should be doing the same."
"Nope, we're both working. He's in his office down the hall, lost in cyberspace. Rudy, the internet junkie, which is a good thing. He has more search engines running all over the universe than England has tubes.
For me to get a search warrant to have Chandon swabbed for DNA, Berger says, I have to show probable cause, Lucy. And a taped phone call not only isn't going to do it, but I'm not sure how much you want leaked outside this office. Especially since we really don't know what the phone call means."
"Nothing," Lucy interrupts.
"You know that's all I ever want leaking outside this office.
Absolutely nothing."
"The unforgivable sin."
Berger smiles, her eyes touched by a gentle sadness as she looks at Lucy's stern, determined face. A face still smooth and bright with youth. A face with sensuously full lips, the hue of dark red earth.
If it is true that people begin to die the day they are born, then Lucy seems an exception. She is an exception to all things human, it often seems to Berger, and for this reason alone she fears that Lucy will not live long. She envisions her compelling young face and strong body on top of a stainless steel autopsy table, a bullet through her brain, and no matter how she struggles to strike that image from her imagination, she can't. Disloyalty, even born of weakness, is the unforgivable sin, Lucy agrees, puzzled and unsettled by the way Berger is looking at her. What's the matter, Jamie? You think we've got a leak? Jesus, it's what I have nightmares about. The nightmare I live with. I fear it more than death. She is getting riled up. I catch anybody betraying, well, one Judas in this organization, and we're all cooked. And so I have to be hard. Yes, you're hard, Lucy. Berger gets up, barely glancing at Sean Dunn's captured voice patterns on the monitor. We have an active unsolved case here in New York. Susan Pless. Lucy gets up, too, her eyes intense on Berger's, anticipating what she's about to say next. Sean Dunn is charged with her murder, and you know all the reasons why I gave in, folded up my tent, decided not to prosecute, and let Texas have him instead. Because of the death penalty, Lucy says. 67. The two of them pause by the soundproof door, monitors glowing, images from closed-circuit cameras flashing from one to the next, and small bright lights winking white, green, and red, as if Lucy and Berger are in the cockpit of a spacecraft. I knew he'd be sentenced to death in Texas, and he was. May 7th, Berger mutters. But no death penalty for him here. Never in New York. She stuffs her legal pad inside her briefcase and snaps it shut. One of these days the DA might allow the needle, but probably not during my tenure. But I suppose the question now, Lucy, is do we want Sean Dunn to die? And more to the point, do we want whoever's in his cell in Polunsky to be executed when we can't be certain who that person is, now that we've gotten these communications from the infamous Lou Garou? Berger says we, although she has gotten no communication from Jean-Baptiste Sean Dunn. As far as Lucy knows, only she, Marino, and Scarpetta have. Letters, and now a phone call that seems to have been made from the Upper East Side of Manhattan, unless technology has failed, or human programmers have. No judge is going to grant me a court order to get his DNA, Berger says again in her usual calm, self-assured tone. Not without probable cause for a search warrant. I get it, and I'll try to extradite him to New York and put him on trial for the murder of Susan Pless. Based on the DNA from his saliva, we'll get a conviction, even if we know that the seminal fluid in her vagina wasn't his, was in fact Jay Talley's, his twin brother's. Sean Dunn's attorney, Rocco Caggiano, is going to throw in every dirty trick he can think of if we bring this case back to life, so to speak. Lucy avoids the subject of Rocco Caggiano. Her expression registers nothing. Waves of nausea roll through her again. She wills them to pass. I will not get sick, she silently orders herself. I certainly would introduce Tally's seminal fluid into evidence, and there the case gets dicey. The defense will argue that Jay Talley, now a fugitive, raped and murdered Susan, and all I can prove without a doubt is that Sean Dunn sank his teeth into her. In summary, she is in courtroom mode. Hopefully the donor of the seminal fluid will be of no consequence to jurors, who will be horrified that saliva found in bite marks virtually all over Susan's upper body will prove that Sean Dunn tortured her. But I can't prove he murdered her, or that she was even alive when he started biting her. Shit, Lucy says. Maybe he gets convicted. Maybe the jurors believe she suffered extreme physical pain, that the murder was vicious and wanton. It's possible he would get the death penalty, but it's never carried out in New York. So, if convicted, he'd probably get life without possibility of parole, and then we'd have to live with him until he dies in prison. Lucy places her hand on the doorknob and leans against thick acoustic foam rubber padding. I've always wanted him dead. And I was glad he ended up in Texas, Berger replies. But I also want his DNA, so we know for a fact that he isn't roaming the streets somewhere, his eyes on his next victim. Which could be one of us, Lucy says. Let me make some calls. The first step is for me to tell a judge I intend to reopen Susan Pless's murder and want a court order for Sean Dunn's DNA. Then I'll contact the governor of Texas. Without his sanction, Sean Dunn's not going anywhere. I know enough about Governor Corley to expect serious obstinance on his part, but at least I think he'll listen to me. It does his state proud to free the earth of murderers. I'll have to make a deal with him. Nothing like justice to help them out at election time, Lucy says cynically as she opens the door. 68. Mid-morning in Poland, a maintenance worker named George Skshipek is sent to room 513 of the Radisson Hotel to fix a stuck drain in a bathtub that is causing an unpleasant odor. He knocks on the door and calls out maintenance several times. When no one answers, he lets himself in, noticing right away that the guests have checked out, leaving a bed of tangled sheets spotted with seminal fluid and numerous empty wine bottles and ashtrays filthy with cigarette butts on the bedside tables. The closet door is open, coat hangers on the floor, and when he walks into the bathroom with his box of tools, he discovers the usual mess of toothpaste crusted on the sink and splattered on the mirror. The toilet isn't flushed, the tub filled with scummy water, and large flies crawl on a plate of partially eaten chocolates set on the counter next to the sink. Flies drone and butt against the light over the mirror and dive bomb Skshipek's head. Pigs. So many people are pigs. He pulls on large rubber gloves and dips his hands into the cold, greasy bath water, feeling for the drain. It is clogged with clumps of long black hair. Pigs. Water begins to drain from the tub. He tosses the wet, matted hair into the toilet and waves flies away from his face, disgusted as he watches them moil over the plate of chocolates. Taking off his rubber gloves, he flaps them at the fat, black, filthy pests. Of course, flies are not exotic insects to him, and he sees them on the job, but never this many in a room, and not this time of year when the weather is cool. He moves past the bed and notes the open window, a typical sight, even in the winter, because so many guests smoke. As he reaches to shut it, he notices another fly crawling on the sill. It lifts up like a dirigible and buzzes past him into the room. An odor seeps in with the outside air, a very faint odor that reminds him of sour milk or rotten meat. He sticks his head out the window. The stench is coming from the room directly to the right, room 511. 69. The car is parked at a meter on East 114th Street in Harlem, within a block of Rouse. In Benton's former life, he could get a coveted table at Rouse because he was FBI and had special status with the family who has owned the famous, if not notorious, Italian restaurant for 100 years. It was a hangout for the mob, and there is no telling who dines there now. Celebrities frequent its few check-cloth-covered tables. Cops love the place. The mayor of New York stays away. Parked on East 114th in a beat-up black Cadillac that Benton bought for $2,500 cash is probably as close to Rouse as he will ever get again. He plugs a cell phone into the cigarette lighter, engine and air conditioning running, doors locked, his scan never leaving the mirrors as he eyes rough people who have nothing better to do than walk the streets looking for trouble. The billing address of this phone is the P.O. box number of a woman in Washington who does not exist. The satellite location of where Benton's call is made is of no consequence, and within 2 minutes he hears U.S. Senator Frank Lord talking to a staff member who is unaware that the senator has activated mode 2 of his international cell phone and will now receive calls and actually transmit his conversation without any alert that can be detected by anyone other than himself. While the senator was testifying on live TV, he checked his watch and suddenly called for a break. Without touching the phone clipped on his belt, the caller, in this case Benton, can hear everything the senator says. He hears muffled footsteps and voices.
"World's greatest obstructionist body, if that isn't the truth," says Senator Lord, who was always reserved but as tough as they come. "Damn Stevens." "He's raised filibuster to an art form, that's certain," another male voice sounds in Benton's earpiece.
When Benton left a text message on the senator's cell phone with the exact time he would make this call, it was the first time Benton had made any contact with him in almost a year. Senator Lord knows Benton is listening unless he has forgotten or didn't get the message. Doubts wrestle with Benton's confidence. He tries to envision the senator, dressed as always in a crisp conservative suit, his posture as straight as a 4-star general's. But the remote, one-sided meeting must be on track. The senator walked out of a hearing that was probably being aired live on C-SPAN. He wouldn't do that without a good reason, and it would be coincidental to say the least if he just happened to step out at the precise time Benton let him know he would call the number in Mode 2. Also, it occurs to Benton with relief, the senator obviously has set his phone on Mode 2, otherwise Benton could not overhear his conversation. "Don't be stupid and so damn jumpy," he silently tells himself. "You are not stupid. Senator Lord is not stupid. Think clearly." He is reminded of how much he misses seeing his old friends and acquaintances in the flesh. Hearing the voice of Senator Lord, Scarpetta's trusted friend, a man who would do anything for her, tightens Benton's throat. He clenches his hands, gripping his phone so tightly that his knuckles blanch. The man, probably a staff member, asks, "Can I get you something to drink?"
"Not now," Senator Lord says.
Benton notices a muscular, bare-chested youth casually moving closer to his rusting, dented Cadillac, a hunk of junk so caked with Bondo the car looks as if it had pigment disorder. Benton stares him down, a universal warning, and the youth veers off in another direction. "He's not going to get appointed, sir," the staff member replies, oblivious that every word he says is being broadcast to a Nokia cell phone in Harlem.
"I'm always more optimistic than you are, Jeff. Things can turn around, surprise you," says Senator Lord,
the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and the most powerful politician in federal law enforcement, because he controls funding, and everything is about funding, even solving the most heinous crimes.
"I want you to leave and call Sabat."
Senator Lord refers to Don Sabat, the director of the FBI.
"Assure him he'll get what he needs for his new cybercrime unit."
"Yes, sir,"
the staff member sounds surprised.
"Well, you'll make his day. He's done all the right things and needs my help."
"I'm not sure I agree with you, Chairman, in the sense that we have some other pretty big issues, and this is going to set off a lot of..."
"Thank you for taking care of it,"
Senator Lord cuts him off.
"I've got to get back in there and make these idiots think about people instead of damn political power games.
And punishment. There are those who aren't too fond of you."
The senator laughs.
"Means I'm doing something right. Give Sabat my regards. Tell him things are moving along well now, or in the woods. Reassure him. I know he's been unsettled. But we've really got to be diligent now more than ever."
The line goes dead. Within hours, money will be wired into various accounts at the Bank of New York at Madison and 63rd, and Benton can begin withdrawals with bank cards issued in other fictitious names.
This book is continued on Disc 7.